This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company, from America for America.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free Samsung 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
There's a recent report, as reported by the Washington Post, that the U.S. is seeing a significant drop in fentanyl overdose death. Double digits, actually, a decrease of nearly 27% from the previous year. That's the what, that's the outcome. There's been a lot of discussion about the why, and here to help us with that discussion is Daniel Flannery, who is a professor at Case Western University and an expert on the opioid epidemic. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
So if you would, the significance of this reduction first as an outcome, and then we'll talk about why we think we're seeing this reduction.
Well, first of all, it's good news that we're having a decline. And this is a decline that's occurring pretty consistently across the country with a few minor exceptions. And, you know, the rates were so high for so many years, it was tough to even get small changes up or down in the rates of overdose fatalities. So I don't think there's a singular explanation for it, but I will say that there have been significant efforts over the last 6 to 10 years now, focusing on prevention and harm reduction strategies and education and awareness and surveillance of just tracking what's actually happening in our communities so that we can respond in more near real time to what's going on, which is not what was happening, you know, 10 years ago.
Obviously, during the pandemic years, we saw significant increases, maybe some of the largest increases we've ever seen in history. Do you think it was connected to the amounts of money that were flowing out on the streets and people were getting this free money and, you know, a lot of the addicts were using that money to purchase drugs?
I can't speak for every community around the country, but we did look at this in our community, and we're located in the northern part of Ohio, which is one of the states that's unfortunately been in the top 4 or 5 in overdose death rates per population since the beginning of this epidemic. And we did see some spike in overdose fatalities with the release of the stimulus checks, for example. Even more telling, I think, was that we saw an increase in overdose fatalities occurring in hotels and motels when people were using alone. So that's turned into a bit of a education and awareness effort to say, you know, you can't Narcan yourself if you're using drugs by yourself. And you can't be, you know, nobody's there to call 911 should you pass out. So not using alone has become a big education and awareness message that I think is part of the reason this has helped. But it's also the drug supply question, right? Fentanyl entered our markets in 2014 or 15, and that's a much more powerful drug than cocaine or methamphetamine. And so that's what really drove the increase in fatalities and the spikes. And in our community, we actually saw something called carfentanil, and 2017 and 2019, which is an even more powerful version of fentanyl. So a lot of the decline could be traced back to the increased number of seizures that are occurring both at the borders and in local law enforcement, and changes in the drug supply. So we're seeing less fentanyl actually in the supplies right now because of the seizures going up and the shifts in foreign markets in terms of who's making fentanyl and how easily or difficult it is to transport it into the United States.
What's interesting now is that, you know, fentanyl, I'm told, I was reading some HIDA reports, high-intensity drug trafficking area reports. I was actually the chairman of the Gulf Coast HIDA for a number of years and the fiscal agent for that organization in my previous life. And fentanyl is still number one in the threat assessment. It's about $1 a pill now. Meth, number two at $1,200 a pound, which is about as cheap as it's probably ever been. What's interesting is, you know, is the identification of how many addicts we actually have in this country. And when you look back 4 or 5 years, you're talking about almost 500,000, maybe a little more than that, that have died as a result of their addiction. And you wonder how much of an impact that has had on the population it's actually using.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure the user population discriminates very significantly between individuals who are unhoused or socioeconomically disadvantaged versus people who are using that have jobs and are employed and still have still are members of an intact family, et cetera. I mean, I think this problem spans all kinds of demographic groups and doesn't discriminate, you know, when someone is addicted. So when someone is a frequent user or a frequent non-fatal overdose person and then becomes a fatality, then this is what the system, you know, is responsible for, potentially failing some of those individuals. So one of the shifts that's occurred, I think, in our community is we're not just focusing on fatal overdose persons, which is an important group to learn from in terms of what they're overdosing from, et cetera. But we're spending more time trying to figure out who are the non-fatal persons. And these are persons that actually are overdosing but survive, and many of them, you know, double-digit times. So getting to those people to prevent them from becoming a fatality is just as much of a task for us as it is to learn from persons who become fatalities. So, yeah, the sheer volume of use is still hard to capture because it's not all known. And even in our own community, we're starting to see people that don't call 911 or EMS or law enforcement because they don't want to be known to the formal systems, or they have community members that have become sort of the self-anointed Narcan distributors out on the streets. So if we're just depending on our emergency departments or law enforcement or EMS to understand who's using and overdosing, I think that's an undercount of who's actually involved with substance use.
In your community, do y'all keep track of the administration of naloxone or Narcan and how many, you know, overdoses are actually averted as a result of the deployment of same?
We do, to the extent that we're able. We have an initiative with our county hospital that's drugs averted, deaths averted with naloxone, Project Dawn. And they distribute tens of thousands of Narcan kits each year through the hospital, through the pharmacies, out on the street, through community events, through EMS. We also have some data around how much Narcan or naloxone does the EMS first responders administer in order for an individual to recover from the overdose. And the amount of naloxone that needs to be administered now is 4 or 5 times greater than what needed to be administered 4 or 5 years ago. So if a 2-milligram dose was effective at bringing someone out of an overdose 4 or 5 years ago, sometimes that person needs 10, 12, 14 grams of naloxone. And sometimes that isn't enough. So So one
because of the purity of the fentanyl, right?
The purity, the amount, the sort of growing dependence, habituation to the drug. It's also, in our community, a complicated toxicology of use. So people aren't just using pure fentanyl or cocaine or methamphetamine. They're usually mixing those things, knowingly or unknowingly. So knowing how to respond and how to treat them becomes a much more difficult issue because it's a multi-drug issue. So now you're getting back to the supply and what are the dealers putting out there on the street and what's being added to those mixtures, things like xylazine and nitazenes that are more tranquilizer type drugs that complicate someone's use and potential recovery.
For the benefit of the listening audience, they're cutting a number of these drugs with like xylazine and others to kind of increase the duration of the high, so to speak.
Yes, or to numb the down, right? To make the coming off of the drug easier to take because it's sort of the physical symptoms that fentanyl and other synthetic opioids kind of create that makes you use it more frequently. So it's a much quicker cycle than someone who historically would take heroin, where they might only need to inject twice a day because the effects of the heroin would last longer. And the downside, you know, of coming off the high is less severe. We see with fentanyl in many cases, it's 4 or 5, 6 times a day that some individuals are using in order to avoid some of the physical consequences of the withdrawal.
What is the most recently reported data as it relates to sobriety 2 years post-sobriety? I know at one point in time it was about 9.5% or 10% of folks were still sober 2 years after reaching sobriety. What are we seeing today?
We're seeing a more complicated picture of what recovery looks like and what sustained recovery looks like. And this is probably one of the big next areas that we need to do better in. I think we are doing much better at connecting people to treatment, diverting them to treatment from the criminal justice system, and providing them some treatment when they're ready and able to participate. What we're not very good at is tracking people through their treatment and into whatever sustained recovery might look like. So what I can tell you is that synthetic opioids just act differently than sort of heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine. So people are telling us that their detoxification period isn't long enough, right? If they get into a inpatient treatment facility in order to get treatment, they're really not even detoxed to the point where they're amenable to anything else before their insurance may run out or before the bed becomes unavailable. So I don't think the sobriety in this particular space is any better than it was in the past. And members of the user community will often report to us that they've tried treatment 4 or 5 different times. And they're still willing to get treatment, but I don't think we've hit on a gold standard treatment outside of the medically assisted kinds of treatments that individuals often try, like Suboxone, that again helps them with their withdrawal symptoms. That creates other problems in our system because we have dry housing and drug-free kinds of programs that say if you're getting something like Suboxone, you're still considered to be a user. So that those right. treatment options aren't available to you. So we have a way to go
always...
here.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say we have a ways to go here on the back end of this continuum, right? We've done a lot better on the education, awareness, prevention, linkage to care, harm reduction strategies so that people can stay alive. But we're not yet where we need to be in terms of this is what sustained recovery looks like and what we need to do for most individuals to get them there, in my opinion.
I guess one of the, and I would agree, I think one of the unpleasant truths, and love to hear your reaction to this, is that we could actually achieve the gold standard. The question really is do we want to go through the exercise and is there the funding available? It's not cheap. And, you know, when you think about 12-step and a lot of ways and a lot of things that we've done to create this kind of behavior modification. I think one of the criticisms has been that these programs are not long enough. And then we fall prey to government funding and financing every time we get a hiccup or there's a downturn in the economy. That happens to be one of the first things that's cut, right?
Yeah, our teams have experienced some of those things already in the current climate, right? So a lot of the things that are occurring sort of on the ground, whether that's peer supporters in the community or in the emergency departments that provide some of that support on an ongoing basis, or understanding the effectiveness of different kinds of treatment modalities. You know, I think some of the things we call evidence-based treatments in this space aren't helping people as much as we think they are over time. And you're right, this is the big challenge, is to be able to track individuals over time, and the resources and effort to do that. Sometimes the political will isn't there, especially for individuals who think this is a failure of moral character as opposed to a physical addiction for individuals that continue to use. So I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think there's things we know we can do. We're not able to do them because we lack the resources.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times we underestimate the importance of the gateway, how people got to the game, so to speak, of the addiction game. Most, I would say, and you correct me if I'm wrong, got there innocently, right? They might have been under treatment for something else, and next thing you know, they're hooked.
That's certainly at the beginning of all of this. That was a big faction of individuals who were being prescribed pain medications and opioids based on a surgery or an injury. A large number of folks in the construction industry, for example. And then there was a shift from, we're going to stop prescribing these legally because they're addictive, and then people turn to the illicit drug market to get heroin and other things. So that's certainly been a significant portion of individuals in this space. Every person, you got to remember, as you do, every individual here is a person. It's not just a number or a statistic.
Yeah.
And everybody has a different pathway as to how they ended up in this particular situation. It's not as if individuals kind of wake up one day and choose to start using fentanyl. We have a number of people who have overdosed and passed away because they thought they were taking something else, and fentanyl was in their ibuprofen or their Adderall that they bought on the street. So part of the education and awareness issue here is that, dealers are becoming very sophisticated in making pills and other things that look like the real deal, and yet you don't know what's in it. And so you can take one dose, and if you're certainly not used to having those kinds of drugs in your system, this can lead to an accidental overdose and end up as a decedent. So there's a lot of pieces and parts to this puzzle that we still need to keep up on. I certainly hesitate to want to think about where we would be at today if we didn't do the things that we've been talking about with test strips and needle exchanges and Narcan distribution and peer supporters and the like. The rates would be much, much higher than they are. So
it's amazing how many. It's amazing how many parents are surprised to hear, with teenagers in their upper years, that, they're Narcan drivers now, like they had designated drivers for alcohol, right?
And yeah, yeah.
And they're like, what are you talking about? I said, yeah, it's real. It's out there.
Yeah, there's been some conversation about Narcan parties. There are people that are the designated Narcan providers for a group of people that are using together. That kind of goes up and down with the narrative in the community. But, we're putting Narcan in vending machines in strategic locations and hotels and motels. And, we need to get past the stigma of if you're using these drugs that you don't deserve help.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Daniel Flannery, professor and director of the Center for Violence and Prevention at Case Western University. He's also an expert on the opioid epidemic. We truly appreciate your time and your insight. Have a great week.
Thank you, Noel. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us, folks.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company, from America for America.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free Samsung 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Recently, there was an article in the Washington Post about that the NOPD had secretly monitored New Orleans with facial recognition cameras. And it lays out a theory about how certain things were conducted and the like. And here to talk to us about is Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog. Skip, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Noel. How are you doing?
Skip, your thoughts about what the Post revealed in their article.
You know, I think they did a nice job. I think it was pretty balanced. I think that there was some holes that need to be filled. And one of the things they didn't discuss is that this is not widely used within the NOPD. It was really restricted to the 8th District, which is the French Quarter. The other districts in New Orleans were not using this for the most part. And most of the officers I've talked to were even unfamiliar with this app outside of the French Quarter. They had to go through a routine procedure for violent crimes for asking for permission to use facial recognition, which is what the city council spelled out. So this is not citywide. As a matter of fact, if you were in the 8th District, there was a room with a couple of very large monitors. I think it's called the Promenade Room, where you would sometimes see this displayed, and you would see these, you know, squares over the face where they're identifying images. So, but the rest of the article was pretty spot on. So I know I know he tried to interview some of the city council members about this, since, you know, the laws were passed by the city council, but I think that no city council member was willing to meet with him. But he did manage to meet Annika Patrick and Brian Lagarde from Project NOLA, and they both spoke with him. But it is interesting. One of the things I teach in my forensics class is the limitations of eyewitnesses. And there are so many of them. Is it day? Is it night? How far are they? Did the person that identified the persons have glasses? Did they need glasses? How good is that person's facial recognition skills? We're not all the same. We look different, and we have a different ability to identify faces. And then, did it happen during a traumatic event? We're more likely to remember something if it was a traumatic event rather than just passing someone on a sidewalk. Eyewitnesses have a lot of limitations, and I don't think we often think about them. We automatically assume an eyewitness is a very, very good source of information. And I think, as you know, as a police officer, this is often not the case.
Certainly, and I would go so far as to say I would believe that the error rate is probably greater of eyewitness identifications than facial recognition. And I think we don't know for sure, for certain, but I think it's going to end up proving itself in that regard. I was curious. It seemed to me that the manner in which procedurally they ended up using this in a very loose fashion, though, made a lot of sense. And they did point it out that, you know, it was no different to me than somebody walking up to a police officer and say, hey, I know that Joe X is wanted. I saw his picture the other day on the news. Well, he's over there at Bourbon and Iberville on the corner. I just saw him. Mm-hmm. You know, and as opposed to getting one of these alerts that are going out that saying, we picked up this individual who's wanted for whatever on this corner, it would seem to me that you have an obligation to go check it out, right?
And yes, absolutely. And I think that you have to think about it in this way. It's a tool in your toolbox. And like any carpenter, if you use a tool wrong, there's going to be problems. And I think we need to coherently think about it. And one of the things that I've seen from the chief is that she seems to be thinking about this in a very thoughtful way about how this could be used. And she's made comments like, I don't want to comment about that right now, which is, I think, excellent. She's thinking about it. How should we do this? But we shouldn't throw the tool away. And certainly when Project NOLA reports that they've had a match, I don't think you turn around and ignore that. I think that would be just ignoring the tool. And there, I guess there's some states that have actually banned facial recognition. I think this is it's a horrible idea. But we do need to think about how to coherently use that. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Look at what other jurisdictions have done and incorporate their best practices. You don't need to write your own brand new set of rules. Just look and see what some other jurisdiction who has thoughtfully thought about this process has done, and then adapt their policies. You don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen the efficacy of the technology just recently with one of the escapees that was identified as being in the French Quarter, right? I mean.
Absolutely. And I think most of us would think that that's a pretty good use of the technology. I think there is a place for it. And like I mentioned, it's a tool. It can be misused. And we need to be careful that it is not misused. But my feeling right now is the city council has to come back and revisit the rules that they put together. I think they are too stringent and restrict the ability of an officer to use this tool in an intelligent way.
Well, it was a typical example of being caught up in an ideological warfare, right? And mm-hmm. to me, it was an emotional overreaction. And it was the same thing that happened with Palantir, with the utilization mm-hmm. of data and creating dashboards as to what is historically experienced crime rates in a geographic region and tracking that and setting out alerts. You know, when you see these anomalies that occur, and they're like, everybody's freaking out about this. Like, what are you talking about? I mean, it's like, yet it's another tool. You're not targeting anybody. You just want to know when things are kind of running amok in a particular piece of geography and doing mm-hmm. it in an automated fashion. You know, and we went from there to other aspects of Palantir, you know, that we were utilizing for intelligence-led policing as though there was something sinister there. The data is the data.
I mean, yes.
It is what it is, you know, and we've made everything sinister.
Mm-hmm. And I think your very first point was it was an emotional overreaction. I think you're right. And I think it just needs to be revisited again. But, you know, there are limitations with it, eyewitnesses, and there's a lot of them. But there are also limitations with cameras. Is it day or night? How good is the resolution of that camera? A lot of these, like Ring cameras, the resolution is quite good if you're within a few feet. But mm-hmm. once you go much further than that, you lose a lot of detail. They're very low-resolution cameras, and you can't do this sci-fi thing where you enhance. You're limited to the number of pixels that camera has. And that is a limitation to these things. So if you're trying to do a lot of matching points on a face and there's not a lot of pixels on that camera, you're not going to get good data. And we have to think about this. And it's going to be a challenging issue.
You may not get good data as to the facial recognition, but there mm-hmm. are other pieces of evidence that are presented. Type of clothing, color of clothing, tattoos, the gait mm-hmm. of your walk, the gait of your run, shoes, hairstyle, you know, which doesn't mm-hmm. require the same focal efficacy that facial recognition characteristics require that are evident in the video, you know, because people immediately focus in on the quality of the facial recognition characteristics and totally want to discount everything else that's on that video.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, if somebody walks with a limp, it's a valuable piece of information. If they favor their right leg as opposed to their left leg, you know, valuable mm-hmm. pieces of information that we totally discount, and we want to discount the entire technology. And again, I think has been an emotional overreaction. I kind of view that in when I hear the ACLU, who is, you know, talking about, and Nathan Wessler was quoted as saying, this is the government giving itself the power to track anyone, for that matter, everyone, as we go about our lives walking around in the public. Well, that's not mm-hmm. what this was. This wasn't the government doing it. This was the private sector doing it. And, you know, neighborhood associations are linking together their Ring camera data all day long. In fact, these neighborhood watch groups that are the most successful in making sure that their streets are safe are the ones that are coming together sharing this information. They're not going to stop this. Government doesn't need to be involved in this, and Project NOLA is a great example of it.
I think you're absolutely right. My neighborhood signed on to Project NOLA after we had a significant murder in the neighborhood, and we put up dozens of cameras, and it made a difference. It made a difference because those things watch 24/7. They watch 24/7, and you and I are just not capable of that. And now, that was some years ago, now adding facial recognition to this, I mean, the cameras can identify not only facial recognition, but license plates. Do we need to ignore license plates now? Do we ignore that a vehicle went through? Because the cameras will identify vehicles.
Sure.
They will separate between vehicles and people and pets. And this is all helpful information. So, and I think a lot of folks, you know, don't understand there's different levels of evidence. DNA is amazingly good, but everything doesn't rise to that level. It doesn't mean that we throw it out like a partial fingerprint. We don't throw out the evidence because it is not as good as DNA. we still use it. And hopefully we gather lots of pieces of information, and together that provides a picture. And this is one of those pieces.
Yeah, and you know, there's some misnomers about, or misconceptions, I should say, about DNA as well. It's not as easily collected evidence as a lot of people want you to believe. You don't leave DNA in thin air, you know, and the likelihood of DNA evidence being recovered is really not a significant difference in a fingerprint, quite frankly, in many respects.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know, it's just a different type of technology, but we've blown it up by looking at television and movies into something that it really isn't.
You know, yes.
There's a belief out there. Let us take a break. We'll be right back. We're visiting with Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company. From America for America.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free Samsung 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog. We've been talking about the Washington Post article by Doug McMillan that talked about Project NOLA and their utilization of facial recognition in some of their surveillance cameras throughout the French Quarter. And as was pointed out by Dr. Gallagher earlier in the interview, that it was predominantly used in the 8th District, not throughout the city. There were a lot of representations that this was a citywide effort, and this is the first time in the history of this country that a city in its totality were utilizing this technology. All of that was false. And, you know, there was another observation, Doc, I want to get your reaction to, that he talked about this report that was done by Bill Bratton, and that he didn't mention in there, they said he did not recommend adding any form of facial recognition. Well, why do so when it's outlawed by ordinance by the city, the same way that he didn't take a position on open carry either in the French Quarter, because that's allowed by state statute.
Mm-hmm. You know, just before your show, I was reading the ordinance, and it placed significant restrictions on the use of facial recognition, essentially saying, sort of after the fact that they could use video and use that facial recognition to possibly identify someone. The restrictions are quite severe. The rest of the city has been using that, but it's almost exclusive to violent crimes. So it didn't permit facial recognition for lesser crimes. And again, it put a number of barriers in the way of using facial recognition. So the rest of the city is sort of restricted to that, while the 8th was using Project NOLA cameras to basically scan any, you know, extensively within the French Quarter, any of the cameras that are there for Project NOLA. Now, again, as you mentioned earlier in the show,
but they were using it in a different way, right? Because they had already reached a probable cause level because they already had a warrant issued for these individuals' arrest. And these alerts that were going out were individuals that were wanted by the police. So that it wasn't like they were trying to link an individual to a crime that had already been established. The only question left was, is this in fact the guy that we want?
Yes, yes. And but that was not going on in other parts of the city. And they were having to sort of retroactively look at video and compare that to an image. And then only for folks that were wanted for crimes that were violent in nature. In the case of Project NOLA, they didn't face those restrictions. And it's entirely unclear whether the city statutes apply to them. It's a private organization with their own cameras. They're not using city resources in that respect. And they are using pictures that are available, mugshots, to scan and look through, actively look through, in real time, crowds. And of course, the quarter has bigger crowds, so a lot of faces going through the quarter. Now that has stopped, and I think that stopped once the Washington Post began asking questions about the practice. So it's a little unusual, and I think the Washington Post found that it isn't occurring in other cities. In other cities, they're using their own resources, and they have their own set of rules that they're following. So, and I think Chief Kilpatrick's been sort of clear about this. She's sort of stepping back to look at this, and I think that's exactly what needs to be done. And then maybe go to the city council, suggest what's needed, or maybe some reforms that need to occur so that it can be used, just as we talked about earlier, as a tool in your toolbox. But you probably have to even address officer training in this, because just because you get a close match doesn't mean that is the person. So, and officers need to realize that it's not 100% like many other techniques. It might be good. It might be even better than eyewitnesses, but it doesn't ensure you have the right person. So,
yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting about in one paragraph, they pointed out, you know, the alert comes out, the officers can pull up a booking photo of the individual on their laptop. They can look at that photo. They can go to the location of the camera where they pick up the individual. They can look at the individual, see if, in fact, it matches the booking photo or the other whatever photo they have in their system, and determine whether or not that's the individual.
Yes. Yes. I mean, and I just don't see a lot of problems with this.
My point is simply, without any additional training, they figured out exactly what they need to do in order to validate, you know, the frailties of facial recognition. Right.
Yes.
By pulling down the booking photo, looking at it and saying, oh, yeah, that's the guy standing right there.
Yep. And if you had an eyewitness reporting something similar, the same sort of behaviors would occur from an officer. And I've talked to students in my forensics classes about whether they would be comfortable with this. And for the most part, they say yes. They are comfortable with this idea.
You get anonymous calls saying, you know, you want this guy for murder. He's standing over here in the parking lot at whatever Shopping Center. You go check it out.
Yes.
We got to get to the break. Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog, thank you so much. We'll be right back, folks.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company, from America for America.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free Samsung 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Nerds. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.